Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and go live to Tampa, Florida, and speak with Jo Freeman, a feminist political scientist, writer, and activist, to get an update on today's activities on the first full day of the Republican convention. We'll discuss how Ann Romney might humanize her husband in a speech tonight and what the Republicans can do to reach out to women, given the recent remarks by Congressman Todd Akin and a Republican platform that opposes all abortions without exceptions. Then we will speak with Ed Kilgore, the principal writer for the Washington Monthly's Political Animal blog. We will discuss the dominance of the current Republican Party by white male evangelicals and whether appealing to their hatred and demonization of President Obama will be sufficient to get Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan elected. Then finally, we will examine how conventions have changed following the turmoil of the 60s, when real politics and passions were on display, into the bland, orchestrated coronations of candidates that they have become today. Elizabeth Sanders, a professor of government at Cornell University, joins us. She has an article in the Cornell International Affairs Review Journal, "The War Lovers Again: What the Foreign Policy Advisors of Presidential Candidates May Tell Us About Future U.S. Foreign Policy." Joining us now is Jo Freeman, an American feminist, political scientist, writer, and attorney. She, as a student at the University of California, Berkeley in the 1960s, she became active in organizations working for civil liberties and the civil rights movement. She went on to do voter registration and community organization in Alabama and Mississippi and was an early organizer of the women's liberation movement. She has authored several classic feminist books and articles, as well as important papers on social movements and political parties. She's also written extensively about women, particularly on law and public policy towards women and women in mainstream politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jo Freeman. Jo, are you there? I think we've lost her. I'm afraid we've lost this connection. Again, we're trying to do a live call to the Republican convention in Florida, in Tampa, Florida, and hopefully we'll be able to get Jo Freeman back on the line and have a discussion with her. Jo, are you there?
Yes, hello? I am. Can you hear me?
I can. I can barely hear you, but Jo?
I'm here. It's very noisy in the background.
Yeah, that.
Your background. My background is very
helpful. Well, now I can hear you. All right. So you've been at every Democratic convention since 1964 and every Republican convention since 1976. So what is it about these conventions that attracts you?
I must be a convention junkie.
That's for sure. So I'm afraid, you know, Jo, we're going to have to try and call you back again. I know you have AT&T, which is the worst phone system on the planet, and we may get a better connection, but it's very, very hard to hear you. So we will hang up and call you back immediately in the hope that through the Russian roulette we'll get a better line. Again, I'm trying to get through to Jo Freeman in Tampa, Florida. She's down there covering the Republican convention. She has been at every Democratic convention since 1964 and every Republican convention since 1976 convention. Jo, can you hear me better this time?
I can hear you. Can
excellent.
You hear me?
I can. Yeah, let's just keep our fingers crossed. Now, the fact that you've been at every Republican convention since 1976 and every Democratic convention since 1964, have you noticed a change from the 60s when we had real passions and politics on display? Since then, in 72, with the rules changes, they've both become extremely bland, orchestrated events. And my understanding is there is no event more bland and orchestrated than the current Republican convention underway in Tampa.
Well, I don't know about plan, but it's definitely orchestrated. They're all orchestrated. Conventions stopped being places for deliberation and decision-making actually in the 50s. The last seriously contested convention was in 1952. 76, the Republicans almost had one, but it wasn't really contested. It was just sort of contested. There were, however, in both the 60s and the 70s, some serious debates over platform issues. That tended to fade from the scene in the 80s and 90s, and now all the platforms have done an advance. They're done pretty much by the candidate's campaign committee. The fact that we have primaries which select the delegates means that we know who the candidate's going to be well before the convention. All the decisions...
Okay, that's AT&T at work. Ladies and gentlemen, we are going to try again. Unfortunately, this is a live program, and there's not much we can do, but hope that we can get through to our guest who is in Tampa, and we are hoping to continue the conversation. Joe, are you back again?
I'm here.
Excellent. Okay. So the as we speak now, Rick Santorum's on. And later tonight, of course, Ann Romney will be speaking. And then the keynote speeches by Chris Christie later in the evening. So Ann Romney apparently has been given the task of humanizing her husband. How do you think she'll be able to manage that?
Well, keep in mind that humanizing her husband is a very traditional role for a candidate's wife. Ever since candidates' wives started to do anything publicly, their primary job has been to tell the public what a good family man their husband is and to make him more human. So that's a fairly traditional thing to do. What's not traditional is to have a primetime speaking role that's hers and hers alone. She's not introducing her husband. She's speaking on her own. She's got a primetime slot. That's extremely unusual. I don't know that this is the first time it's happened, but if it's not, it's certainly close to the first time it's happened. So you're seeing both tradition and innovation in Ann Romney's speech tonight.
Now, is that to suggest that she will have a prominent role as a first lady, more so, say, than Nancy Reagan?
That's a little hard to say. I mean, Nancy Reagan's role was not that out of line with tradition. It was behind the scenes. The real breaker with tradition in the modern course of events was Hillary Clinton, and she got shut down a lot for doing it. Whether Ann Romney will follow Nancy Reagan or Hillary Clinton is a little bit too soon to tell.
Well, Joe Friedman, the other task ahead for Ann Romney tonight is apparently, in general terms, the Democrats are the mommy party and the Republicans are the daddy party, and about, I think, 10 million more women vote than men. So to that, by that measure, the Democrats have an advantage with the women's vote, offset by the Republican advantage with the men's vote. So what's your sense of how Ann Romney might overcome some of the skepticism that I think a lot of women in this country have about the Republicans, particularly following Congressman Aiken's recent remarks and the fact that the Republican platform excludes all abortions without exceptions?
Well, she's not going to have Romney come out in favor of, but she's not going to say her husband's in favor of abortion. Don't look for anything, even remotely, on the issue of abortion. It's simply... won't be there. What she might do is, this is Mike, because I haven't read her speech, what she might do is talk about how her husband has taken good care of the family and how he provides for his children as a way of implying that he will take good care of the country and provide for everyone. Again, that would be the way it would be conveyed as against the Democratic form, which would be a little bit different than that. So, even if the Republicans are the daddy party, it would be the daddy as protector and provider. That would be the image she'd be trying to project.
Whereas the platform portrays the daddy as the kind of Puritan scold.
Well, he's that too. And the Republican Party certainly is a Puritan scold these days.
Well...
But you remember, she's going on primetime TV not to talk about Puritan scold.
Of course.
She's going on primetime TV so the people will feel comfortable with her husband. So she's not going to do this. She's not going to repeat the platform.
So, Joe, what have you seen today in terms of activities outside the convention as opposed to what we're talking about? Obviously, we've got Santorum speaking now and Ann Romney later and then Chris Christie. So anything that you can report on what happened today?
Oh, sure. The thing about both conventions is they attract people and events of a very diverse nature. Everyone comes here to do something. Today I have been to a presentation on our Mexico policy, our relationship with Mexico. I went to another one for the National Foundation for Women Legislators, which was talking about health care as a women's issue. And the National Foundation is a bipartisan entity. It's not a Republican entity. And then I went to a presentation on unconventional women, in which there was a whole series of panels on various women's issues. Those same presentations are going to take place at the Democratic Convention. Sunday and Monday were protest days. There were at least four different marches going on Sunday and Monday. I think I managed to go to two of them. In addition, there were small protests going on at other places. Code Pink, the women's group which formed in response to the Iraq war, has been out at a variety of functions demonstrating its opposition to the war on women, demonstrating its opposition to war, period, talking about a wide variety of issues particularly pertinent to women. There has been a march for economic justice. There was an ice sculpture up in a park. An ice sculpture was said middle class, which was set up to melt. The whole point was of the ice sculpture was to talk about the declining middle class. In addition, there are three cars driving around with cages on the top and toy dogs inside. These are a way of mocking Romney. There are billboards on trucks driving around with various messages on them. There's a billboard near the convention center with quotes on climate change by various Republican officials. I mean, everyone comes here to politics, and the convention is a magnet, and they come here to do their own thing, even if none of them are going to actually go into the convention. So you have an awful lot going on. You asked me earlier why I come to these things, and I guess it's because it's such a three-ring circus. Barnum and Bailey, it's Disneyland, it's Treasure Island, all rolled up into one with a political twist. So you can come here to eat, you can come here to play, you can come here to politic, you can come here to talk issues, and you can do all of those things.
Well, I understand speaking of eating, my understanding is that the lobbyists have literally bought up all the expensive restaurants for their clients.
That may be. I haven't been in any expensive restaurants. but certainly the lobbyists are here in droves, and they will be at the Democratic Convention in droves. They will not be absent from those things. You're going to have a lot of very expensive fundraising parties going on. The Coalition for Faith, which used to be called the Christian Coalition, had a private luncheon, which was closed to press, and then they had a public forum, which was open to press. That's an issue group, an advocacy group, but certainly the lobbyists will be here for anyone that has an interest in government doing what it wants, what the lobbyists wanted to do, will be here as a marvelous opportunity to talk to politicians, to talk to decision makers, and maybe incidentally to talk to delegates who might become politicians and decision makers.
Well,
so,
Joe,
I wouldn't be too surprised.
Well, Joe Freeman, I thank you.
I'm
just going to say, I'm sorry for running out of time, but I thank you so much for joining us.
Okay. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Again, I've been speaking with Joe Freeman, an American feminist, political scientist, writer, and attorney. As a student at the University of California, Berkeley in the 1960s, she became active in organizations working for civil liberties and the civil rights movement. She went on to do voter registration and community organization in Alabama and Mississippi and was an early organizer of the women's liberation movement. She has authored several classic feminist books and articles, as well as important papers on social movements and political parties. She's also written extensively about women, particularly on law and public policy towards women and women in mainstream politics. And she's been at every Democratic convention since 1964 and every Republican convention since 1976. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with Ed Kilgore.
Tell. Mix a special groove with fire and sun. but I'm a Mr. Two, and you're giving Mr. a bad name, Mr. Like You. So I'm taking the Mr. from out in front of your name, 'cause it's Mr. Like You that puts the rest of us to shame. It's a Mr. Like.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ed Kilgore, the principal writer at the Washington Monthly's Political Animal blog. He is also the managing editor of The Democratic Strategist, an online forum, and a senior fellow at the Progressive Policy Institute. He was formerly vice president for policy and democratic leadership at the Democratic Leadership Council, communications director for U.S. Senator Sam Nunn, and a federal state relations staffer for three governors of Georgia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ed Kilgore.
Thank you, Ian.
And the stage tonight in Tampa at the Republican convention's opening night, of course, it's their rival for media attention is a hurricane, Isaac. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, one of the things I find interesting about the lineup is how few representatives of the United States Congress are there. There is an African-American young woman from Utah that they're featuring, but given that Paul Ryan is on the ticket, is there a possibility that they don't want to advertise the world's least popular Congress?
Well, that's probably true. They're also sort of pretending this is an outsider ticket because it's headed by a former governor, even though he doesn't like to talk about being governor. So, you know, by and large, with approval ratings of Congress, and particularly Republicans in Congress, being historic lows, no, they're probably not real crazy about identifying the party with that particular crowd.
And what do you think?
But they're not a very diverse bunch either.
Right. Well, that's, I think, obviously why this African-American congresswoman is being given the stage.
Yeah, that and, you know, the apostate Arthur Davis, a former Democratic congressman who was once very close to Barack Obama, who's now, after a fairly bitter primary defeat running for governor of Alabama, has suddenly decided he wants to be a Republican, so he's going to be featured too. He's sort of the Zell Miller of this convention.
And then you've got Ted Cruz, who just won in Texas. Do you think having Ted Cruz and having the African-American congresspeople and the potential governor on is going to do the trick in terms of winning over minorities?
No. No, I mean, they have to make a show of diversity, such as it is. That's a tradition. But, if there's anything that's pretty clear about this particular Republican ticket is they're doubling, maybe tripling down on getting as large a percentage of the white vote as possible and are just, you know, pretty much doomed to a very poor performance among both Hispanics, African Americans, and even Asians. So, yeah, they'll say they're diverse. It makes them feel good, but this is not a Republican ticket that's in the outreach of any sort.
So, but is it a winning ticket, Ed Kilgore? Can you win with white votes alone? I mean, he's clearly been throwing bones to the angry white men. All this advertising campaign that completely lies about the waivers on welfare.
Yeah.
Which is designed to make, you know, blue-collar Reagan Democrats angry, thinking that the bunch of minority freeloaders are getting their money, and then throwing a bone with this remark about the birthers, the reference to him not having, nobody ever asking for Mitt Romney's birth certificate, all seems to indicate to me that that's one who he's going after, but it's also the fact that he seems to be shoring up this base would indicate to me that they're behind in there, aren't they, in what you'd normally be doing at this point, be reaching out to the center?
Well, there hasn't been much reaching out to the center from the very beginning, and that's in no small part because, two reasons. One, there's a pretty small undecided vote this year. And secondly, the conservative activist base of the Republican Party doesn't trust Mitt Romney. And with his record of flip-flops over the years, he's just in an unusually poor position to move in any direction other than towards the right. Can you win with this sort of strategy? It's mathematically possible, but it's hard. I think Ron Brownstein has estimated that Romney would probably have to win 61% or in the neighborhood of 60% of the white vote to win. That's the level that George Herbert Walker Bush won against Mike Dukakis in 1988, and that was a virtual landslide. So it's going to be tough. But I think the calculation here is that these attacks, bringing back the old welfare queen meme, is kind of a twofer for Romney. It pleases the conservative activist base, which really does have a lurid conspiracy theory sort of view of Barack Obama as the other representative of the underclass and the elites who are trying to, loot virtuous middle-class people. And at the same time, it has a historic appeal to non-college-educated white voters who make up a pretty sizable chunk of the undecided vote. So it's the rare example where they think they can simultaneously move to the right and appeal to swing voters, a very, very specific category of swing voters.
Well, of course, there's a film out now that's paid for by Republican deep pockets. Dinesh D'Souza's film that is designed to, I think, first of all, I mean, it's based on his book, which was made absurd claims about President Obama harboring anti-colonial views. And anybody who knows anything about Obama's father, he was a member of the ruling party, and he was being groomed for a position in the ruling party, and he witnessed a political murder and wouldn't go along with the ruling party, and they hounded him to his death. So if anything, Barack Obama's learned from the fate of his father is that he would not have an affection for an anti-colonial government, that's for sure.
Well, I mean, I don't think the facts are that important to these folks. The whole reason they're going in this direction, this sort of secret theory of Barack Obama, is that by most reckonings, the man's been a pretty moderate president of the United States, constantly trying until recently to reach out to Republicans, was embracing policy prescriptions that Republicans until very recently were embracing. So you kind of have to come up with a secret theory that he's not who he says he is, not what he appears to be, that he's part of a long-standing, secular socialist plot to expand government, buy votes, and take over the country. It's pretty sad that a significant percentage of the American people buy this stuff, but it's what a big chunk of the base actually believes, which accounts for a lot of the kind of feverish hatred of the man.
Well, that, I think, raises a real question about the United States and about the kind of equal and opposite idiocy that exists both on the right and the left. There's a tendency to gravitate towards conspiracy, both on the right and the left, and it seems, I don't know what the size of constituency is, but it is considerable, and it is...
Well, I don't know. I mean, I understand what you're saying. I don't see a whole lot of conspiracy theories on the left at the moment.
Well, no, this is the 9/11 conspiracy.
Yeah,
there.
I know, but that's a tiny, 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 tiny portion of Democrats that buy into that stuff.
Right. Well, I think
they're always going to be extremists on both sides.
Right.
I agree.
Right. Well, I guess
what alarms me is how large a segment of the Republican base seems to buy into these kind of lurid theories about Obama, and use it to sort of whip themselves up.
Sure. Well, I think it leads one to speculate about whether or not the Republicans who have been hostile to they've many of them wanted to close down the Department of Education. They seem to be hostile to education, and whether one could make the argument that the Republicans have made a wise investment in ignorance.
Well, it's not so much ignorance as it is their whole separate universe of facts. I put that in air quotes. That's communicated through a sort of closed loop of conservative media, to the point where, the classic example, and you've already mentioned it, are these ads about Obama's welfare policies, which, virtually anybody and everybody who's looked at the facts suggest are outright fabrications. And as somebody who worked on welfare policy in the 1990s, and was actually involved in the effort to enact the 1996 welfare reform legislation, these ads are just a pack of lies. But, you know, conservatives want to believe what they want to believe, and they think it makes sense to them that Barack Obama would secretly try to unravel welfare reform and, you know, just dish out unconditional money to his people. And so they buy it.
Again, I'm speaking with Ed Kilgore, who's a principal writer for the Washington Monthly's Political Animal blog. He's also the managing editor of The Democratic Strategist, an online forum, and a senior fellow at the Progressive Policy Institute. He was formerly vice president for policy at the Democratic Leadership Council, communications director for U.S. Senator Sam Nunn, and a federal state relations staffer for three governors of Georgia. And given that the Republican Party has become a Southern party as a result of, in large part, of Lyndon Johnson signing the 1965 Civil Rights Act at the time Johnson said, we're going to lose the South, it's become a Southern party. Do you find it a little odd that this Southern party has a couple of Northerners at the head of its ticket?
Well, I don't think it's a Southern party. You could certainly make the case that a particularly Southern kind of conservatism rules it now. But, I mean, you look at a guy like Scott Walker from Paul Ryan's home state of Wisconsin. There's nothing Southern about him, but he certainly, you know, has a view of economic development and government management that would be perfectly in place in South Carolina right now. And at the same time, you know, the South, is parts of it are still competitive. I don't think Mitt Romney has ever led a poll of Virginia. So I wouldn't put that kind of regional label on it. I think what's interesting is that the Republican Party has lost its regional diversity entirely. And now you can go just about anywhere in the country with the possible exception of Maine, and Republicans all pretty much embrace the same highly conservative ideology that used to be confined to the South and the West.
So then, to correct the notion that it's a Southern party, it's certainly a party that's dominated by Christian evangelicals. Is that a more accurate way to describe it?
Well, I would say that they hold a mortgage on the Republican Party's soul. The Republican Party is not, or its presidential candidates are not allowed to embrace any positions that are hostile to the Christian right. I'm sure they'd be happy with having somebody other than Mitt Romney as their presidential nominee, since most of them do not consider him a Christian. But the important thing is that he's with them on the issues. So no one is allowed to be pro-choice, pro-gay rights, that sort of thing. So, yes, indeed, it's a party in which the whole Tea Party movement, I think, is a grossly misunderstood phenomenon. It's basically just the latest incarnation of the conservative movement, which has been working to dominate the Republican Party since the time of Goldwater. And as I've argued today, you know, I think the convention in Tampa is the sort of event that the Republicans who nominated Barry Goldwater in 1964 would have recognized and liked. It's a long march of the conservative movement. And the Christian evangelicals and even some libertarians are part of a grand coalition that supports remarkably similar policies.
But this would indicate then that anti-intellectualism is set in stone here, because if you have a party dominated by Christian evangelicals who in many ways are anti-intellectual in their wanting to teach creationism as opposed to evolution, and then you have the influence of the Koch brothers and the powerful oil companies, which essentially own the Republican Party. And it's worth noting, for example, one of the Republican congressmen is now trying to stop the United States Navy from investing in alternative fuels, which is a national security imperative. You know, here we are apparently about to have a war with Iran, and the Gulf is going to be cut off, the oil supply, and the Republicans are now insisting that the Navy give up on its efforts to find alternative forms of fuel. You've got the Koch brothers basically funding this anti-science, anti-climate change. So modern-day Republicans can't admit that climate change is real, and they can't admit that evolution is real.
Well, you know, I mean, it. Frankly, I don't know that it matters that much whether it's avarice driving it or some rather eccentric views about human history that fundamentalists embrace. I mean, part of the problem is that, you know, the business community the large corporate community has abandoned any particular interest they have in sort of social progress. And at the same time, the Christian right has suddenly divinized laissez-faire capitalism. You know, the economic conservatism of the Christian right is pretty remarkable, too. So it's a grand coalition around what they call constitutional conservatism, which involves, you know, a rigid view of government responsibility, absolute property rights, all wrapped up in a package that conservative evangelicals think was literally dictated by God. It's a very powerful belief system we're talking about here, and I'm not sure that every single element of the coalition buys into exactly the same rationales for it, but they do pretty much agree on the same agenda. And it's pretty much what Republicans were advancing in 1964.
Well, just in closing then, Ed Kilgore, I recall recently when Barney Frank retired, he made the remark that, you know, he was retiring because he couldn't stand the nature of gridlock and the polarization, and it didn't recognize the Congress anymore. But he made the remark that the Republicans have essentially become deranged, in as much as they either embrace Michelle Bachmann's kind of crazy rhetoric, or they feel they have to embrace Michelle Bachmann's crazy rhetoric. Otherwise, Michelle Bachmann will run against them in the primary. So what is the explanation for the fact that there's pretty much, as far as I can tell, particularly with Senator Lugar being knocked off by a Tea Party guy recently, I find it hard to find any of this endangered species known as the moderate Republican.
No, they're pretty much gone. I mean, they've been going for quite some time. I mean, what's happened now is that the conservative movement has itself been radicalized over the last few years. And at the very moment that it's finally achieved its long drive to control the Republican Party, so you have a more radical ideological movement now completely controlling one of the two major parties, and that's bound to produce some pretty serious polarization. And keep in mind that this radicalized conservative movement believes in extraordinarily rigid and fixed views of what government ought to do. It doesn't matter whether the economy's good or bad, or really what's going on in the world. It's exactly the same vision they have, which is why they're kind of struggling to make the claim that they're so focused on the economy this year. They'd be promoting exactly the same agenda if the economy was booming. It's an ideological vision, not an agenda attuned to any particular challenges facing the country.
Well, that's a pretty grim prognosis for America in the 21st century, led by Mitt Romney.
Well, I think the only way you, I think as the president said, the only way you break the fever is to administer a beating or two. There are a lot of historical forces that have produced today's Republican Party. It's not going to go away. But, without any question, if Mitt Romney is president and Republicans manage to control both houses of Congress, the Ryan budget will be implemented almost instantly, and we'll have a very different future for the country.
So just in closing, you're leaving me with a nightmare here, Ed Kilgore. What's going to get the same number of people out in 2008 to vote in 2012? We wouldn't be having a discussion about the race being close if everybody that voted for Obama in 2008 voted in 2012, right?
Probably not. I think the Republican Party is really helping. I mean, the remarkable thing that's happened just in the last few weeks is that the Romney campaign abandoned its whole strategy for this presidential campaign. They were going to run it as strictly an economic referendum, on the president, on the performance of the economy during the Obama administration. They were going to treat the president with kid gloves as a guy that was just sort of in over his head, and just sort of give the light touch to Mitt Romney's personal background. They've abandoned all of that. You know, by putting Paul Ryan on the ticket, they've made it a choice election rather than a referendum election. And certainly they're going savagely after the president now in ways that may appeal to the voters they're trying to appeal to, but could also produce a pretty serious backlash and motivate a lot of 2008 Obama voters, you know, particularly minority voters, to the polls. So I think we're going to have a high turnout election all around.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Ed Kilgore.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Ed Kilgore, who's a principal writer for the Washington Monthly's Political Animal blog. He is also managing editor of The Democratic Strategist, an online forum, and a senior fellow at the Progressive Policy Institute. He was formerly vice president for policy at the Democratic Leadership Council, communications director for U.S. Senator Sam Nunn, and a federal state relations staffer for three governors of Georgia. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about Romney's neoconservative foreign policy team.
How low were you willing to go before you reach all your selfish goals? Impatient after impatient, this means war. This means war.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Elizabeth Sanders, a professor of government at Cornell University. Her research interests lie in American political development and popular politics. She is currently working on a book, Presidents, War, and Reform, and has an analysis of Mitt Romney's foreign policy at the Cornell International Affairs Review Journal, The War Lovers Again, What the Foreign Policy Advisors of Presidential Candidates May Tell Us About Future U.S. Foreign Policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elizabeth Sanders.
Thank you for having me.
And you have written in your article what we should be talking about, Romney's foreign policy advisors. You've quote President John F. Kennedy saying, domestic policy can hurt us, foreign policy can kill us. Given that there are a lot of the neoconservatives who brought us the Iraq and Afghanistan wars as presidential advisors to Mitt Romney's foreign policy team, do you expect this issue to come up, foreign policy? Are they going to in any way broach it, do you think, in this convention?
I don't think they'll have a lot to say about it in the convention because economic issues, I think, seem much more promising to them. There is a considerable reluctance in the American public to get involved in another war. If you look at the deliberative polling that's been done, where they really ask people, they show them the budget, what it looks like, and so on, and say, where would you cut? There's a great sympathy for cutting the military budget. Israel is threatening to start a war with Iran and drag the U.S. into it, and that actually makes a lot of Americans very nervous. So I don't think that's going to be something that they talk about a lot. But since we've been there before, we've seen these people. This is now their third iteration. A lot of them came from the Reagan administration. Actually, a number of those neoconservatives left Reagan when he started negotiating with the Russians. They decided he was wimping out. And then they turned up again in the George W. Bush administration, and one might have thought they'd have been discredited for their disastrous war policies, but here they are again. I have to say it surprised me to see the whole gang back with Romney as his foreign policy advisors. And I think, given that we didn't recognize in 2000 that the advisors, they called themselves the Vulcans at that point, that they were going to turn American foreign policy in a much more aggressive and ambitious direction, I'm a little wary of it this time, and I think we should look at advisors. It's unfortunate that we don't.
Well, we know that John Bolton wants to be the next Secretary of State in a Romney administration, and he's apparently lobbying heavily for the job.
And if not him, his protege, who's one of the advisors.
And his protege being whom?
Oh, I've forgotten his name, I'm sorry to say. But one of his best friends and a guy who's identified as a protege of John Bolton, a younger guy, not very well known. is on the list. I think they kept off. There are a couple of people who are not on that list. Well, Dick Cheney's not on the list, but also Bolton is not listed formally as an advisor because he was a very controversial fellow. And also Elliot Abrams, who was in and out of the Reagan and George W. Bush administration, a rather controversial guy who was actually convicted of a crime and would have gone to jail had he not been pardoned by the first George Bush. So those people are advisors to Romney. He does talk to them. They talk to other people on the list. But Bolton, you know, even George W. Bush didn't have much luck getting Bolton appointed in a real position at the UN. So I wouldn't expect that to be tried again. But these are people whose voices will be heard. I think Romney is quite sympathetic to them.
So you mentioned in your article, Elizabeth Sanders, that one of Mitt Romney's advisors has been accused of war crimes in Lebanon, and another academic advisor has been an advocate of the El Salvador solution to insurgencies, referring back to the bloody war in El Salvador. Who are these people?
Elliot Cohen is the principal academic advisor, and he has said, I have some links to his articles in that article you're talking about, and he has said, look, you know, and people are very wary of sending a lot of troops to crush insurgencies, but we had a better way in the Reagan administration, which was just to to find a client government of conservatives and give the military a lot of money and let them put down the insurgency, and then American lives wouldn't have to be lost. I was really surprised to see him giving several speeches about that was a good idea. If you're going to have, you know, an aggressive foreign policy and try to control what goes on in other countries, and you don't want to send your own soldiers, then the obvious alternative to that is to have clients. But that worked out so badly for Latin America, if not in Latin America, and places like El Salvador and Guatemala are still trying to recover from those levels of violence that were facilitated by U.S. military aid. And the other guy is a Lebanese guy who was a Lebanese Christian who was accused of being a part of the massacre in 1982 in Lebanon and in the Palestinian refugee camps. And he also has sponsored some very controversial anti-Islamic ads and including that training film that was shown to the New York police force. if you followed that.
What's his name?
His name is Walid. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm not looking at my article now. But it is in that article. I would recommend anybody who wants to get all the information on these advisors to follow that link in the Cornell International Affairs. And I have a list of about lots of people, 60 people. And I'm sorry that I don't have a... I could go and get a copy of it.
No. Let's continue.
Sorry.
Again, I'm speaking with Elizabeth Sanders, who is a professor of government at Cornell University. Her research interests lie in American political development and popular politics. She's currently working on a book, Presidents, War, and Reform, and she has an analysis of Mitt Romney's foreign policy at the Cornell International Affairs Review Journal. The title of it is The War Lovers Again, Why the Foreign Policy Advisors of Presidential Candidates May Tell Us About Future U.S. Foreign Policy. And presumably you can pick that up online. How do you do that? Go to what, Cornell International Affairs Review Journal?
Yes, it's all there. You great. Flip through to page 20. It flips as if you're turning
sure.
the page.
Well, so the role of former Secretary of State and National Security Advisor in the Bush administration, Condoleezza Rice, is fairly prominent at this convention. She's apparently being feted at many of the behind-the-scenes. She's apparently at a big fundraiser the Koch brothers held some time back. She blew everybody away. So
she's an amazing woman. She's extremely intelligent and articulate. Very impressive.
But her record is a complete disaster. She was a disastrous.
I would say so.
She was a total disaster as a national security advisor. One of the fundamental jobs of a national security advisor is to protect the president, even from himself. She ignored everything that the Clintons had told her about Al Qaeda. and they have basically, it's amazing how she's gotten away with. And then, of course, she was one of the big promoters of the Iraq War. She was the one, after all, who talked about we don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud. She didn't form a natural alliance with the Secretary of State, Colin Powell. Instead, she abandoned him and didn't confront Cheney and Rumsfeld, the real powers in the Bush administration, left Colin Powell to hang out to dry, and ended up getting his job.
And it is really sad. Well, she did get his job, so there's an incentive. But had she lined up with Powell, given that she actually did have considerable influence with Bush, they were very close. She might have changed things a little, and she's very smart. She knows a lot of political science and history, and it was just very sad to see her abandon all that and not live up to the potential she had.
And as Secretary of State, she achieved zero. Can you tell me something she did? I remember she kept trying to find a peace with the Palestinians. She was the one that was blindsided by the election that brought Hamas in. It's pretty hard to believe that she's anything but...
But, you know, I suppose it's too bad she hasn't written real memoirs, but if you've noticed in the last 2 years of the Bush administration, there were no new wars, even though there were people clamoring for a war in Iran, very strongly clamoring, Vice President Cheney and the Israelis pushing very hard. So who knows, maybe she helped to discourage that.
Well,
there were also resumed negotiations with North Korea. So, I mean, I have no idea whether she was behind those diplomatic initiatives, but there was a definite difference in the last 2 years of the Bush administration, I think.
Well, it's true that the Cheney and company did try to get a war with Iran going in 2007, and it was largely blocked by leaks from a woman on the National Security Council, who's now hiding out in Australia, still being hounded by the FBI. Again, I'm speaking with Elizabeth Sanders, a professor of government at Cornell University. Her research interests lie in American political development and popular politics, and she's currently working on a book, Presidents, War, and Reform. Let's talk about some of the writing that you've done in terms of conventions themselves and how they have changed in the modern era. We, of course, as consumers of politics and as voters, are the worse for it, are we not, that both the Democrats and the Republicans now in the modern era since the 60s basically put on a PR show that's devoid of everything except photo opportunities and flags?
You know, they aren't very good for us observers anymore, but they probably still serve the purpose they were originally designed for, which is to have some unity across a party that, you know, spans a continental-sized country and that is quite regionally diverse. And the idea of bringing these people together and giving them a sense of common purpose so they go back and campaign for the ticket was always one of the big missions of the convention. And that, in a way, may be even more necessary now that these people, for the most part, are not long-term participants in politics. A lot of them are novices going to their first convention. They're not office holders. Many of them, in the old days they were all office holders. So, you know, they had a sense of being a Republican or a Democrat. So there may be some induced unity among these people, you know, at the parties, hearing the speeches, waving the flags. But it certainly, there's no mystery anymore. And there are not going to be any fights. This is one of the most controlled conventions that I remember. So you're just not allowing any dissidents, and it's very stage managed. Of course, the Republican convention has always been somewhat more top-down control. The Democrats, you know, as a party, are just more fractious and diverse internally. So perhaps bound to give us a few fights here and there.
Well, they shut out Ron Paul. He was apparently given the option of speaking as long as Mitt Romney's people could edit his and review his speech. And he felt, I talked to his chief advisor a couple of days ago, and he said that there was no way in the world that he could sign off on the very thing we've been talking about, which is...
And it's really too bad that he didn't have a chance to put his voice out there because he's saying things that nobody else is saying.
Well, exactly. I mean, it was because he just simply could not sign off on a neoconservative foreign policy that appears to be what's in store if Mitt Romney becomes president. But you've written that conventions used to matter much more before the era of rules reform that began in 1972. And in the 1960s, you actually had debates about party policy and directions. And it was the Democrats in 68, after that debacle in Chicago, that changed the rules in a way that have made these conventions sort of bland and predictable. Is that a correct description of what you're saying?
Sure. You said it very well. So there's just not as much interest. And yet, some people will be watching in that rather small, rarefied group of independents now who haven't taken sides between the parties. And they'll want to know what kind of people these are and whether they feel emotionally attached to them. And so maybe the speeches will tilt people over in the Romney direction who've been skeptical. I mean, that function still could be achieved. It has been at a couple of Democratic conventions, I can recall, with Clinton and Obama and so on, that they sort of galvanized the convention and drew people to them. So there's a chance for Romney to do that, or for his wife to do it for him.
Well, her job is apparently to humanize him. And I guess to some extent reach out to the women. We do have a kind of polarized political party system in this country. The Democrats are the mommy party and the Republicans are the daddy party.
The warrior.
Yes, the authoritarian figure, as George Lakoff refers to the Republicans, and the yielding nurturing mother on the Democratic side. There are, of course, 10 million more women voters? So Ann Romney's got an uphill climb, hasn't she?
Well, she does. And, of course, the way our politics are stacked, we have one of the smallest percentages of women in the legislature of any democracy. It's really, really down there, 17%. I think Rwanda has twice that percentage of women in their parliament. So we don't get a lot of nurturing in our politics because women are really not there. And it's interesting the way Republican women, too, have become so stridently conservative. I heard a really interesting talk by a political scientist looking at the voting records of women in the Republican Party and how there really is no gender gap there among Republican women in the party and the legislature. They're just as conservative or more conservative, and they make very, very strong speeches to sort of prove they're one of the guys. So it takes more than just having women there if the voice is sort of snowed under.
So do you think that this election will be decided by money? I mean, that is, as a political scientist, Elizabeth Sanders, you've surely noticed that this is an extraordinary phenomenon, how much money is pouring
in.
It's going to be a $6 billion election, apparently.
No, it's horrific. And, one might feel a little sorry for Obama, except that he started the whole thing when he threw aside public funding for the first time since it had existed and decided just to raise his own private money. And now he realizes that the other party can be pretty good at that, too, especially with the help of the Supreme Court decision. But, one way I think it's going to make a difference, I haven't seen this film yet, and I don't particularly want to pay to see it, but the film, the movie on
Obama 2016, you mean?
Right, which has a lot of money behind it, and without all the money behind it, might not be there. It's a part of the attempt to get at Obama's biggest advantage over Romney, which is personally, people like him more than they like Romney. And I think, if they can pull in independents or Democrats into those movie theaters, it could conceivably have some effect in making Obama not as likable, not as, as warm and appealing to people as he has been. So that's one way that money will help to win. The most important issue, obviously, is the economy. And that, for political scientists, that's about all you need to know. Presidents who preside over an economy growing at 3% or more always get reelected. And those who are there when the economy's not doing that well almost always get defeated. So that's kind of that's one of the few laws of American presidential elections. And if Obama did win against that economic trend, it would be quite remarkable.
Well, just in closing, Elizabeth Sanders, it seems that the three factors here that could bring about a Romney victory are the suppression of votes, 5 million Democrats. We're in an era where people who want to vote Democrat are denied the vote, even if they voted before and are registered voters. They have to jump through hoops to prove who they are. Meanwhile, a handful of billionaires buying the election for the Republicans don't have to reveal who they are. They're spending record amounts of money. And then the third factor is, of course, the possibility of a little war. And that is one of the things that you've written about in your article. Your concern, and many people share this because of what the Israeli press are reporting, and that is the determination of Netanyahu and Barak to go to war against Iran. Do you think that is a wild card that could put Romney over the top?
You know, part of my conference paper is looking at incentives to make war, and one of the sort of reassuring things that you find in the data is that presidents almost never go to war close to their own elections because they think it would look really bad. But if he doesn't, if Israel attacks and he doesn't back it up, if it needs backing up, maybe it won't need any backing up and he can just sit back and watch. But if Israel seemed to be getting pounded in retaliation and he didn't step forward, then, you know, he might be in trouble. So I'm sure it's a dilemma that he does not want to face. But Israel knows enough about American politics to know how to game it. And if they think the chances are good that he'll win, and so he'll be less reliable as an Iran war starter than Romney, which I think is the case, then they'll go ahead and call his bluff before the election. I hope they don't. But who knows? I could not predict it.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Elizabeth Sanders.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Elizabeth Sanders, who's a professor of government at Cornell University. Her research interests lie in American political development and popular politics. She's currently working on a book, Presidents, War, and Reform, and she has an analysis of Mitt Romney's foreign policy at the Cornell International Affairs Review Journal, The War Lovers Again, What the Foreign Policy Advisors of Presidential Candidates May Tell Us About Future U.S. Foreign Policy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producers Michelle Manos and Brooke Peterson. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.